yeah, to be in the same page with all the people that, listen to us. So what is capitalism? Or can you describe the current economic model we live in?
That's a very difficult question, and I may not be the right person to ask that even. Capitalism is many things and many different things to different people, right? But historically, it is that phase of development where we moved away from feudalism, which was centered around agricultural land, to industrialization, which was centered around the ownership of factories, right? That is where the word capitalism came from. So that is one definition of capitalism. Another definition, let me turn off my email because it makes noise. Another definition of capitalism is in its opposition to communism, where the main difference between capitalism and communism is then the private versus the public or the state ownership of the means of production, right? And I think both definitions in the historical sense and in the sort of like economic system sense are acceptable definitions of capitalism. There is a third definition, and that is, of course, that capitalism stands for everything that is wrong with society, according to certain people. And that is a very amorphous definition, right? Then it's just like, yeah, something is wrong, it must be capitalism. But that is, I don't think, a workable definition at all.
From our understanding, capitalism, one of the key tenets or one of the key working, I don't know how to call it, but it's the idea of growth, right? So constant growth and continuous growth. And like in the last century, a lot of people have pointed out how that conflicts with the physical world in which we live in. So how can we maintain this model within capitalism, right? Like this idea that we can continuously grow while there are natural limits to what we can do.
Yeah, no, that is indeed one of my objections to calling this one of the flaws of capitalism, right? Because you're not talking about capitalism at all. If you look at what Mao and Lenin and Stalin were planning, was also very rapid industrialization and also very rapid economic growth, right? So this is not a problem with capitalism per se. But you are right that there is now also a vocal, small but vocal group of people who argue against continued economic growth. That, of course, started with Malthus, right? Was probably the first to point that out. It continues with the Club of Rome. And now, of course, we have the people who describe themselves as degrowth, right? That, or agrowth, as some people call it. I think there are various things wrong with the degrowth movement, and let's just focus on them because they are the ones that are around at the moment. The first is the term itself, right? Degrowth is not an English word. We have a proper English word for degrowth. It's called shrink, right? If something doesn't grow but gets smaller, we don't call that degrowth, we call it shrink. The fact that people do not dare use the proper English word immediately suggests that they themselves don't really believe what they say, right? If you're for something, then you should just call it the way it is. If you're against fascism, you should just be against fascism and you don't come up with a euphemism. You may shorten it to Antifa, right? But yeah. you're that's something that you should be proud of, right? If you stand for something, you should be willing to say what you're standing for. Or if you're standing against something, then you should be willing to say what it is. So these people advocate economic shrink, which, given that a very large number of people still live in abject poverty, is, I think, a morally repugnant thing to say. They often wave their hands and say we can solve this through redistribution, but that just means that they haven't done the sums right. Right? They're simply, if you redistribute the money that there is equally, then there would still be people living in bad poverty, right? So that the numbers simply do not add up. So that is my first objection. And of course, people will not accept redistribution, right? So it's also just politically not expedient to say these things. It's just it's the sort of thing that well-to-do professors who have tenure can afford to say, right? It's not something that you can say in the real world. I don't believe that for 1 minute. The more fundamental objection goes back to the Simon Ehrlich wager, right? So I said that degrowth is just the modern manifestation of the Club of Rome. And one of the founders of the Club of Rome, Paul Ehrlich, had, of course, a bet with Simon, Julian Simon. Julian Simon, right? Not Simon Julian. Julian Simon, about the price evolution of all sorts of commodities, where Ehrlich clearly lost the bet, even though there's still some people sort of hold out that if you massage the data long enough, then they will find a different, give a different message. But Ehrlich lost that bet, right? And the conclusion that you can draw from that, I think, should draw from that, is something that actually goes back to the Nobel laureates Solow and Romer, that the ultimate resource is human ingenuity. That as long as we keep getting smarter, we can keep growing richer in the broader sense of the word. It is, of course, true that we live on a finite planet and there's a finite amount of iron and a finite amount of copper and everything on the planet, right? There's no denying that. We're nowhere near using that limit for most commodities. But as long as we keep using things in a smarter way,
we are able to substitute so far to a certain degree, right? Right now, some consumer market goods, what we can find out there, what we can buy out there, is to a certain degree substitutable to with like some natural, let's say, natural benefits that we get from ecosystems and the other way around, right? Mm-hmm. So this happens like right now, but like, is there any like a possibility that, for example, this substitution degree can or is there any evidence? Have you like do you have any insights on whether this substitution can keep going as the climate warms, or as our planet warms?
That again is a very difficult question. It's obvious that we have never run into that limit in our existence, in our evolution as a species, right? So we have no empirical evidence that such things really exist. And these reconstructions of collapsing societies in the past, they were never monocausal, right? And it's very hard to find societies that collapsed because of environmental deterioration only, right? And of course, the fact that there was a collapse in Easter Island 1,000 years ago does not mean that we will collapse, because we are not Easter Islanders. There's many more of us, and circumstances are completely different, right? In that sense, this is not an empirical question, right? And this is also the sort of question that you do not want to turn into an empirical question, right?
Yeah.
You do not want to run this experiment. I think the answer lies in what you expect and what your aspirations are and what would happen, right? So at the moment, there are people living in very hot places. Actually, if you look at the distribution of humans in climate space, then we have sort of curled up to the extreme limits of temperature at the top end, right? There's very cold places where humans don't want to live, but there is no place hotter than where humans have chosen to live, right? So we have sort of curled up to the warmest place that there is on the planet, right? We haven't quite moved to Venus yet, but we found the hottest place possible, and that is where humans live, and apparently live there of their own volition and live a decent life, right? But the question is, of course, what is life like there, and is that acceptable and imaginable? And one of the hottest places, one of the hottest countries on the planet is the Arabian Peninsula, right? And what people do there in Qatar and in Kuwait and in Saudi Arabia is they actually live for most of the summer, and actually for a good bit of spring and fall as well, they live indoors. And they just don't go outdoors because it's just too bloody hot, right? I don't know whether you've ever been there, but it's very, very hot. And that is in many ways a rich society. I wouldn't necessarily call it a developed society, but technically advanced, economically prosperous, socially backward, unfortunately. And that's apparently livable. Right. So in that sense, you should not worry, I think, about other sort of hard limits there. Are there things where you say, well, humans can't survive? I mean, humans are like cockroaches, right? We're the last to fall. The question is, do you think that is an acceptable lifestyle? And if I ask you, then you probably say no. I would not want my children or my grandchildren to live a life like that. But then again, your children or grandchildren may think that is normal and have absolutely no problem with that. Because also in terms of what we accept as normal, humans are very adaptable. It's not just that we're very good at inventing new things. We're also very good at convincing ourselves that what is going on around us is normal and fine. And that makes the question, what do we want for our children, actually a bit irrelevant in that sense, because it's what they want and what they experience, and that is conditioned by their experience, not by our desires, right? There's very clearly, futures in which I would not want to live, right? Which is not the same as that other people would not want to live that in those futures, right?
Maybe just like a one that is like really that really comes to, like the, at this moment that is really relevant, which is like for example the environmental Kuznets curve and and how, yeah, like can you explain this? This part and how, I don't know, to what extent this plays a role in like our current society and climate change in this case.
The environmental Kuznets curve is just a big joke, right? And the joke is that this is the most cited paper by Alan Kruger, who is famous for his work on causality, and it's just an association, right? And that is the joke. And Alan himself told this joke, right? He can't anymore. I mean, the environmental Kuznets curve essentially posits that in very low levels of economic activity, very low levels of economic development. There's very little pressure on the environment. Then that increases with industrialization, and then that falls again as the economy further develops, right? That is, in a nutshell, the environmental goodsness curve. Now, there's two problems with that. One is that, if true, this is an association. It's not that the environment improves because we grow richer, but the environment improves because we no longer accept a bad environment and therefore invest in an environmental cleanup, right? So there's no causality there. It's an association. The second problem with the environmental goodsness curve is that it's not stable or robust or even true in the data. It depends on what data you look at. The turning point where things get better again is different for every environmental problem, and it's different for every different economic sector and for every different country. And of course, it's also in some cases simply not true. And the idea that sort of the primitive societies, agricultural societies, did very little economic damage or environmental damage, sorry, it's just not backed up by data, right? I mean, if you look at the extinctions of megafauna at the hands of hunter-gatherers as they entered new continents, those people did a lot of environmental damage of the sort that we can't do anymore, right? Because all these animals are gone. And the same is true for the early slash-and-burn agriculture, right? Lots and lots of deforestation at the hands of early agriculturalists. So, yeah, the environmental goodsness curve is, I mean, it's a nice way of thinking about these things, that environmental pressure is not constant. But both in terms of, I mean, there's no policy conclusions that follow. And also its empirical validity, I think, is very, very questionable.
So the
joke is on Alan Kruger, right? But he's also known for how very careful his statistical work is. And his most famous work is the least robust of all.
As long as you keep, like, for example, like importing to your like a richer society, or not allowing this pollution in your in your country, but as long as you keep like exporting some or importing some goods that come from other countries that are maybe with less let's say less regulations or less environmental policies. If the carbon emissions are emitted there, well, it affects, again, like the global climate, no? So I don't know, like, to what extent, like, this nice inverted U shape really works for a global pollutant as carbon. So I don't know. Any thoughts?
You're absolutely right there. If anything, the environmental goodsness curve holds for such things as sulfur emissions, right? Where you see a clear pattern like this in Western Europe and in North America, and then you see a similar pattern in South and East Asia, where actually the turning point is slightly lower, and you can explain that by technological advance, right? So for sulfur and other sort of air pollutants, there seems to be an environmental goodsness curve. If you look at the literature on the environmental goodsness curve for carbon dioxide, it's all over the place. There is just, I mean, the empirical literature there is just not robust. There are people who claim there is one, and there's an environmental goodsness curve, and there's other people that there is none, and there's people who say it looks completely different than in the previous study, and so on and so forth. There's so many papers on this. And if you put all those papers together, I don't think there's any conclusion whatsoever that you can say this is how it is. And that is partly because CO2 or energy use is such a diffuse problem, right? There's so many sources of energy use that the idea that there would be a simple relationship between CO2 emissions and something else suggests that you don't really understand how the energy system works, right?
I wanted to ask you about what are the tools or the market, which ways in which the market can, in a way, start controlling these, like the emissions, like how can we start moving on towards those things, which we still don't see happening as fast as we want to?
I am less pessimistic than you are. I've been teaching the economics of climate change for 20 years now. And 20 years ago, I would have given that same message, right? So that we know technically what the alternatives are to fossil fuels, but there's all sorts of things wrong with wind power and solar power and hydropower and wave power and tidal power. And the long list of all the alternatives, and they're too expensive and unreliable and so on and so forth. Now, that was true 20 years ago, it was true 10 years ago, it was true 5 years ago, but now solar is the cheapest source of the cheapest way of making electricity, and wind is following close after. And that has mostly that has something to do with climate policy, right? With the creation of demand for these things, but most of the price drop has to do for wind. It's mostly economies of scale in production, a little bit of material science, a little bit of automation and control science, right? For solar, it's mostly advances in material science that drive down the price of solar panels, as well as advances in manufacturing, right? Particularly economies of scale. of course, there's still the fundamental problem of non-dispatchability and intermittency of these sources. But if you look at the advances in battery power and battery storage, which actually mostly comes from advances in material science, and it's mostly used to be driven by our desire to have laptops and mobile phones, and now it's driven by our desire to drive electric vehicles, and that batteries have become so cheap compared to where they were 5 or 10 years ago, that at least for the decarbonization of the electricity sector, we can now see a solution, right? Whereas 5 years ago, I could not see a solution. And I actually could not see a solution coming by the year 2022. And that is actually true for most people who have been in this field for a while, that we are surprised by the rate of technological progress in wind and solar and batteries. Most people have been surprised by this. there are solutions there, right? And some of this came from policy, right? And of course, as an economist, you're obliged to say that we need a carbon tax and a uniform carbon tax and nothing but a carbon tax, right? Because that is what our textbooks tell us. But actually, these things were kickstarted by good old industrial policy, right? By wind power, I understand best the origins of the wind power revolution were laid in Denmark in 1970, where they just developed these things and developed these things, building on a long tradition in precision engineering, and a willingness of a government to subsidize this and keep on subsidizing this for 20 years until the Germans took over and were willing to subsidize it to an enormous amount of money for 5 years or so. And from that point on, sort of it sort of self-propelled from there on. These were... I mean, if you look at opinion surveys about climate, then everybody's worried about climate change, but nobody's willing to do something against it, right? That's a bit like the weather in England. So people are not willing to make large sacrifices for climate. They are prepared to pay a little bit of a carbon tax, but not a large carbon tax. They are prepared to pay a little bit more for cleaner energy, but not a lot. So the solution to the climate problem lies in offering people better alternatives, cleaner alternatives that are just as cheap or just as expensive and just as reliable and convenient, right? I mean, people don't care where the electricity comes from, right? What matters is that your laptop works and that the lights go on, right? And you don't care where, how that electricity is made, right? It's completely irrelevant to most people, apart from a few nerds, right? And as long as the price is affordable, you're happy with this, right? And the same is true for transport. People don't care about driving a diesel car or a petrol car. They care about going from A to B, right? So as long as you offer alternatives that are roughly the same price and just as convenient and reliable, they will switch, right?
So I would just like to have a clarification from your side. When you say like getting richer in the broader sense, or like where the economies like talk about like how wealthy we're gonna become, what do you take into account? Is this only money
absolutely not. When I say richer in the broad sense, I mean in the broad sense, right? And I mean, these things correlate with your monetary income, obviously, and your monetary consumption. There's things that you enjoy that cost money, right? And of course, if you're desperately poor, then that weighs on your mind, right? If you can't afford to feed your children, then that is your primary concern, right? or if you can't afford to educate them or give them proper healthcare, then poverty is a real, real concern. But if you're rich enough that those constraints fall away, then it's not so much about money anymore, right? Then it is about living a fulfilling life. And that is indeed how you see expenditure patterns change in richer countries. That it's no longer about material consumption, but the income that people have goes more and more towards experiences, right? And there's lots of people, and definitely in Europe, there's lots of people who are willing to accept a lower salary if that means a higher quality of life. People who work 4 days a week rather than 5 days a week, because they want a longer weekend. People who want longer holidays to spend more time with their family and accept lower salaries in return. That is something that you see all the time in the richer parts of society, right? Obviously, this is much less of an issue if people are desperately poor. but as soon as your basic needs are met, and people make these trade-offs and they go, and you see that in how people spend their money and how people spend their time, that it's not about money at one point anymore, right?
Yeah, so at some point, it's like, to what extent you like you are willing just to give up your part of your salary or part of this income to experience this other type of goods, benefits, or experiences that fulfill our life, no? So what I see is that at some points there is like this other side of the coin, which are like the experiences are type of like many times are damaged by climate change, no? And which is like access to, a clean air, right? Or just like a recreation sites or like aesthetic views or like what we call in general or what has been called the ecosystem services, no? Which is more like broadly known as the nature contributions to people. So sometimes it's like there's gonna be an I would say that when we think about if we can like keep getting richer like with our ingenuity is not only of how keep growing the economy in the traditional sense, like in the monetary way, keep growing the salaries, the income, but also like how we assure that we can keep the growth of the other side, no? Like the growth or at least not the decrease of the other like non-market goods, no? So I say that's the problem.
Absolutely, and I don't need to explain to you what are the implications of climate change for nature, right? Because that is what you did in some of your work for your thesis. A while ago, we did a study of the implications of sea level rise for natural for cultural heritage, and in Europe, or actually around the Mediterranean, because it was such a trade-oriented society, all the old stuff, all the nice old stuff is right on the coast, right? Because it all was paid for by trade, and it all went by ship. So a lot of that stuff is threatened by sea level rise, right? Obviously, so you should be very careful. But at the same time, you should also be realistic and say, well, climate change is not the only threat to these things, right? If you go to Kilimanjaro, right? That is just a waste tip at the moment. Same true for Mount Everest, right? You can't climb up there because of all the bodies that you meet. Machu Picchu, I probably pronounced that completely wrong, is just overrun with people, right? So it's not just climate change that is a threat there. And obviously these things are very valuable and need to be carefully preserved, right? And then the question is how to best preserve these things. What is the best strategy? CO2 emission reduction would be part of that strategy, but it would not be the only thing in the portfolio, right? Absolutely.
Yeah.
And same is true for people enjoying themselves in nature, right? That is another reason to, or people just enjoying the fact that there is nature.
Climatología es un podcast del Programa de Investigación en Cambio Climático de la Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México. Para conocer más detalles, visita la bitácora en www.pincc.unam.mx/climatología. Este podcast es producido por Estudios Planeteando con la conducción de Raisa Pilatowski y Bernardo Bastien. Postproducción por Raisa Pilatowski. Comité Asesor, Francisco Estrada Porrúa, Julián Velasco Vinasco, Óscar Calderón Bustamante, Alma Mendoza Ponce, Avi Aro, Constantino González Salazar, Teresa Guadalupe de León Escobedo, Miguel Ángel Altamirano del Carmen y Carlos Alejandro Luna Aranguré. Música por Kevin MacLeod y Chris Zabriskie bajo la licencia de distribución Creative Commons por atribución 4.0.